Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicky Nichols Goldstein, presently back in Roatan, Honduras, but not much diving this time, since the island recently got stormy and it's been flooding. And what's going on, Vicky? How's the recovery going?
Well, the ocean is roaring and there's lots of big waves. There are some challenges with erosion, both from roads and from development. So sediments are flowing into the ocean and that is never good for coral reefs. Also, there's been flooding in different communities and people have lost some homes and furnishings. So it's a real problem for the locals with this extensive rain. So it all pretty much goes back to our favorite term, climate change. So
it's a warmer, wetter world, and if we don't build wisely on the shore, we pay the price. Our guest today, Erin Hudson, is trying to do good. She's director of the Seafood Watch program at the world-famous Monterey Bay Aquarium, where she's championed sustainable seafood for more than 15 years. Her work includes studying the real-life impacts of conservation programs like the Watch on the global seafood market. The program that got started in 1999 has included a small, regularly updated folding consumer guide. I've got one in front of me that people can carry into a store or a restaurant. It's divided into green, yellow, and red. For seafood that's a best choice, green, good alternative, yellow, or that you should avoid, red. More than 65 million guides have been distributed to date. And we'll get into all of that much more. But first, Erin, let me ask you what we ask a lot of our guests, which is, how did you first connect with the ocean?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, and my dad is a surfer, which means most weekends were spent at the beach. And as I got older, he taught me to surf and just being out there on the water on my board, because I spent a lot more time sitting on the board than actually catching of the waves. But just the sitting itself was just this very magical Zen experience, almost like going to church. And the ocean was really just this place of wonder and beauty. And it just kind of instilled in me from a very early age that want to keep it that way.
So how'd you get from there to here? What made you make your career choices? Did you just know that you wanted to be a ocean scientist, or how'd it go?
I knew that I wanted to do something involving the ocean. I just didn't know exactly what. So I just kept pursuing coursework that was interesting to me. So really kind of fell into that marine science pathway in undergrad and graduate school. And shortly after getting out of graduate school, there was an opening at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And the Monterey Bay Aquarium's mission is to inspire conservation of the ocean. And that really hit home for me. And that's, I just knew I wanted to be there.
What has your 50 years at the aquarium been like? The water's a heck of a lot colder than down in Southern California.
Definitely, yeah. I will say I do not get out on the surfboard as much here. It is cold up here, but the beauty and all of that is still there. It's so wonderful.
Well, when you have an aquarium, you just go into your fantastic exhibits and it's like being in the ocean. So that saves a little bit of wetsuit wear and tear.
Yes, it
right,
does.
Right. And how'd you come specifically to the Seafood Watch program, and what's it do?
Well, the Seafood Watch program, it's a ratings program. So we assess fisheries and aquaculture operations against our science-based standard for environmental sustainability. And we use those ratings, that green, yellow, red traffic light, to create sustainability recommendations for seafood. And that's really the backbone of our work. We provide those recommendations so that consumers and businesses can make informed choices about what they want to eat, what they want to source. And those recommendations and their guidance also allow us to work directly with seafood industry to actually improve fishing and aquaculture practices.
So it started almost at the beginning in 1999, the beginning of the sustainable seafood movement. And what drove it at that time? Was it like that the regulations for ocean fishing weren't working, or what was the original idea?
The aquarium, you know, actually has its literal history. It was built on a history of overfishing. It's built on an old sardine cannery that started in the 1920s when sardines were having this huge peak that spurred on this big booming fishing and canning industry. But then the sardines vanished in the 40s and 50s and the canneries closed. So the aquarium opened on that very historical foundation of overfishing. And Seafood Watch was actually, it was a temporary exhibit in the aquarium. We had an exhibit in 1997 called Fishing for Solutions.
I remember that.
Yeah. So it was, you know, about shrimp fishing and farming. And we were introducing concepts like bycatch, overfishing, habitat destruction. And so as part of the exhibit, we changed some of the options in the cafe, some of the seafood options that we were serving. And we put out these little tabletop cards to inform guests about some of the menu changes that we had made. And it turns out people kept stealing the table toppers. We couldn't keep the tent cards stocked. So between that and between all of these guest questions asking, you know, guidance on what to eat, that really was the birth of the Seafood Watch program. So the program became official 2 years later in 1999.
And it's been very successful. So how do you define sustainable seafood? And then what criteria must a farm or a fishery meet?
So we define sustainable fishing as seafood that is both environmentally, economically, and socially sustainable, something that can live on into the future. So for Seafood Watch, we're really honing in on that environmental piece. And for fisheries, we're actually looking at four different factors to determine sustainability. So really looking at this kind of holistic view. So we're going to look at the health of the target stock. So whether that's a tuna fishery, right? Is that tuna fishery being overfished or is that at a healthy level? The second thing we're going to look at is bycatch. So what is the health of all of the fish stocks that are being caught alongside that target species? Third, we're going to look at habitat impact of the fishing gear itself. Does it have an impact on the ocean floor, for example? And then finally, we're going to be looking at management effectiveness. How effective is management at limiting the impacts of that fishery?
I like having those four clear things. Now, what about with the farm? What is the criteria for farming and aquaculture?
Right, because most people don't know. It was only 2 years ago that the UN's FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, pointed out this really world historic shift where there's now more seafood is coming from aquaculture, from farming, than from wild capture. It's 130 million tons that's raised versus 90 million tons still being taken out of the wild ocean.
So aquaculture, we actually look at 10 different factors. I won't rattle all of them off, but it's really about looking at what are the inputs to the system. So evaluating how efficient is fish feed, for example, what are the chemicals that are being used on the farm? And then also looking at the outputs of the system. What are the outputs impact on the surrounding environment? So things like effluent, is the wastewater being treated? Things like escapes, what happens when farmed fish escape and what is the impact on wild populations of those escapes? So looking at both the inputs and the outputs of that system.
So most industries start off dirty, and certainly with aquaculture in the 90s, we saw a lot of the salmon farming and shrimp farming that had destructive impacts. But you visit some of the ocean areas, like an R&D plant I visited in Hawaii. And the whole focus now seems to be both less inputs in terms of feeding fish to farm fish, and also developing lower down on the food system to look more at kelp and seaweeds and shellfish as healthier. I visited a mussel farm in Maine where the owner bragged that terms of carbon input, it was healthier to eat mussels than to eat soy. So it's a rapidly changing industry. How do you deal with all the rapid changes in aquaculture and I guess also in commercial fishing?
We see that change over the last 25 years of this track record of aquaculture. And I think aquaculture has gotten, you know, bad press. Some of it well-earned in the past, but lately things are changing. And really, we want to make sure that people are hearing that farmed fish can be done quite sustainably, right? There are green options. There's the whole span. There's green, yellow, and red options. So look for those green ones. But really, by limiting those inputs, like you said, for feed especially, you can really get some highly sustainable aquaculture species. So things like mussels, oysters, clams, and even some shrimp that are being farmed in more traditional unfed systems can be great options. In terms of keeping up to date with it, you know, we're looking at each assessment at least every 3 years, updating that, making sure that we are staying on top of the science to stay up to date. And that is something to remember, that ratings do change, right? So you might see something 10 years ago on your wallet card and get that in, you know, your head that it's X, but you do want to check that recently, because we do update the ratings and things change.
I want to go for a moment to talk about shrimp, since it's been brought up within the aquaculture framework. And at one time, shrimp was a no-no. As you mentioned, that there's more traditional farming in certain areas where local communities are actually engaging in it, and you're not seeing as much destruction of the habitat. And I just think there's like such a big level of confusion. So maybe give us some tips on how to choose shrimp, where you can feel comfortable eating it, and any other info that can guide us.
At the heart of it, it's really important to remember how you fish and farm matters. And that's why, you know, we do ask those three questions when we talk about sustainability. It's, what is the species? Where is it from? How is it caught or farmed? Because those three aspects really determine whether something is going to be sustainable or not. And that's also why you're not going to find a broad statement on our site like, this is all good or this is all bad, because those nuances really matter. So with shrimp, for example, we have green, yellow, and red ratings for shrimp on our site. Some of those green options are going to be where you have really strong management regulations looking into it. So farmed U.S. shrimp is going to be something you're going to look for, or that the inputs, that feed and chemical use, is really low because the systems don't need it. So for example, black tiger prawns is something where in these traditional systems, no external feed, no use of antibiotics, right? So already they're inherently a better system because you're not putting those inputs into the system. So just knowing what to look for and where to go to is some of your go-tos for shrimp, because the majority is not, it's not green.
When we were talking about shrimp, we know that there have been a number of uses over the years with TEDs, turtle exclusion devices, to try to reduce bycatch. But then there's concerns with oil from the shrimp in the Gulf.
Right. And with shrimp, bycatch was huge. I remember going out with other journalists on a fishing boat, and they were pulling in the shrimp and boiling it on the deck for us. And I was like watching them shovel the whelks and everything else off the side. I was taking notes like, that's awful. This is delicious. That's awful. This is delicious.
Yes. So bycatch is still a concern for wild shrimp fisheries due to the inherent nature of how they're catching it. I will say that we're seeing some improvements over time. But again, you know, kind of knowing it is a function of the fishing method. So we do have some yellow ratings for wild-caught shrimp from the U.S., but also some red ratings for other places.
I know that in the Pacific Northwest, they're using traps, so that reduces the bycatch significantly.
Yes, that's a great example. And those traps really are, you know, reducing that impact of bycatch, so you can get some great spot prawn from the West Coast and from Canada as well.
And I've always believed and still believe that if you are eating wild-caught salmon from the Northwest, you are also promoting ecosystem health. You know, you having freer flowing rivers without as many dams, you've got good habitats, you're supporting the indigenous people who are also fishing in that area. Is that still true today?
Yeah, we definitely want to support those green rated and eco certified fisheries and aquaculture operations, because, you know, there are livelihoods and nutrition that depend on those industries. So by choosing, being more selective with what you're choosing, you are encouraging those businesses to operate in that way.
What is Rising Tide? Rising Tide is Blue Frontier's bi-weekly half-hour show that features a diversity of ocean voices from the famous to the fascinating. Deep sea explorers to whale wranglers, Arctic residents to climate justice warriors. With public broadcasting under attack, Blue Frontier offers Rising Tide and all associated content for free to community and public radio stations across the nation. We need your support to keep producing our salty, in-depth conversations. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help us keep getting the word out about our awesome blue planet. And now, back to the show.
The wild salmon are, you know, heroic, Homeric travelers that also reflect the health of ecosystems. And you're seeing, you know, scientists looking at the salmon starting to spawn in the Arctic Ocean on the Arctic rivers. It's no longer just sustainability in terms of overfishing or polluted forms of farming. You're looking at these other factors too, I imagine, and that's got to be difficult to look at the changing ocean and what that's doing to fisheries.
Yeah, we are seeing a lot of changes, as I'm sure you're aware, right? But we're also seeing a lot of, you know, fisheries pop up in places that they didn't exist before, or invasive species, and trying to understand, you know, what is the best way to deal with these and to, you know, to start fisheries where they weren't before. There's a great example of a project we're working in Tunisia on blue swimming crab, where you're having invasive species of blue swimming crab show up, outcompete the existing swimming crab fisheries, and really working with partners there to help fishers transition to target the invasive species and to actually develop that as a fishery and to create supply chains. I mean, really just thinking about how do you work with these changing conditions and how do you create a market for it, right? And so we really try to also work with culinarians to, you know, encourage and showcase how does one cook with this? What are some things you can do with it? And also with business partners to encourage, you know, the sourcing so that you can find some of these species in restaurants and really encourage that development of a market for species like that.
I recall there have been some conversations in the past about putting together trash fish dinners. So tell us more from your perspective what the trash fish might be and how that factors into the sustainable seafood program.
And why we shouldn't call them trash fish.
Maybe, right. Maybe we should start with that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we are encouraging the development of markets for some of these invasive species. But also in my day-to-day, when I talk to consumers, I often try to get them to think a little bit outside of the shrimp, salmon, tuna bubble, right? It feels like most people are just familiar with those species and that's all they eat. And there is a whole lot of other choices out there. And so really by broadening your horizons and trying some new species, not only can we alleviate pressure on those three commodities, but you can also, you know, get introduced to some really delicious, really sustainable seafood. So I feel like I'm on promotional marketing campaign for certain species like Arctic char or shellfish, sparmed scallops. So I'm always, you know, pushing a few poster species that I'd like to see.
Well, while we're talking about this, I love this. What are just some general tips that you would like to give people about rules of thumb for choosing sustainable food from the sea?
Yeah, choosing sustainable seafood can be complex. I will fully admit that. And so when I'm talking to, you know, my friends and family members are like, Ken, you know, how do you make it simple? You know, tell me what to do. And so I always start out by, you know, reminding them that the most important thing you can do as a consumer with your voice is to simply ask the question, do you serve sustainable seafood? And just asking that indicates your demand for sustainable seafood that actually has this incredible ripple effect, because the server will turn around and go to their manager. The manager will turn around. Like, that question actually ripples up the entire supply chain until we get that business calling us and being like, hey, we need to do something about sustainable seafood. Can we work with you? So just your one question has this incredible power. And it's actually one of those times where the question itself can be almost more important than the answer, because the server might not know, But that demand for sustainable seafood, that indication is still happening. And that's the trigger that we need to make all of that happen. So that's first, just ask the question. But second, you know, I always encourage people to kind of develop their own personal go for it list, right? So you have a couple of favorites that you can turn to or you're looking for on a menu. And so for me, you know, I'm basing that off of what I love to eat and what I'm likely to find. So in my area, you know, my personals are going to be farm mussels. I'm always going to choose that if it's on the menu, farm scallops and sand dabs because of, you know, where I am on the West Coast. Those are mine. But when I talk to people, I always ask them, what do you love to eat? Let's, you know, let's at least come with like three go-tos that you can always turn to. So that's an option. And then the third is to choose to shop and dine at places that have made a commitment to sustainable seafood. So then you don't have to do your homework, right? You just know that everything in there is good to go. So those are kind of the three ways that I always encourage people to utilize the Seafood Watch ratings.
And one more that you sort of referred to when you said sand dabs. Eating locally, knowing what's in your local waters. Last time I was at Jersey Shore, it was like everybody's ordering tuna steaks and salmon. And it's like there's striped bass. There's the quahog clams. I mean, here in California, we love our Dungeness crabs and kind of look down on the East Coast blue crabs. Be into your local waters. But I guess two bigger questions that, you know, one is sort of going back to the origins again of the sustainable seafood movement, because while management of edible marine wildlife was failing, they have this thing called sustainable maximum yield, which was this fisheries theory that ignored things like pollution and climate change or the tendency of people to cheat. So sort of the wild fishery is still in a state of decline, and how do you address that? And then the follow-up question would be, how successful is the sustainable seafood movement in terms of the global seafood market that exists today?
We've really kind of evolved in our approach over the last 25 years, right? So I think we really started as a market-based program, very focused on environmental sustainability with these clear, you know, red, yellow, green for consumer choice and really letting the consumer voice drive that movement. But as time went on, we've realized that, you know, some of the most popular seafood products, things like shrimp, salmon, and crab, were making very little progress in terms of addressing environmental issues and continuing to receive Seafood Watch ratings. So we knew that we had to address some of these bigger, deep-rooted social and human rights issues that are intertwined with the environmental issues that are keeping things in the red. And so we actually expanded our focus to include things like equity and human rights issues in seafood production. So we now work collaboratively with local industry, with scientists, with governments to work on not just environmental, but also social and economic issues needed to improve the sustainability of seafood production. And we're really first there to better understand, you know, what is keeping things in the red. So in farmed salmon in Chile, for example, it's really about antibiotic use, right? How do we reduce antibiotic use? And these questions, there's no easy answer to these questions. If there was, we would have solved it 25 years ago. So these are, you know, large, complex problems. And we're really bringing together people from various areas, from government, from academia, together to really start to unpack and come up with ways that we can work with industry to chip away at some of these things.
So, and like, these Chilean farms, the salmon farms, are you seeing progress?
We are. So we have an initiative with the Chilean Farm Salmon Association to reduce antibiotic use. And in the last 5 years, we've seen about a 30% reduction in antibiotic use from where they started. There's still work to be done. Farm salmon is still rated red by Seafood Watch. But, you know, it's understanding and being able to share the best practices among industry so that learning can happen and we can start to actually implement some of the bigger changes that are needed to continue this trajectory.
So like the antibiotics are used because of the crowding of the fish and increased disease spread among the fish. So it's kind of a function of that.
There's a lot of different things going on, but yes, antibiotics are used to control some of the disease that's happening. So they're, you know, exploring different things like using larger smolts to start out with, to really look at understanding the location of the farm and how that plays with ocean dynamics and flushing of water and temperature. And there's just so many factors going in there. So really trying to understand what things they can control and what things are still needed, like a vaccine, for example, to reduce the need for antibiotics in general. So a lot of work still to be done, but just to say, we recognize that they're not simple and that we need to do more than just issue the rating. We need to actually work with industry on some of these bigger solutions.
It seems that there's more awareness in the EU and Europe on sustainability in fisheries, maybe less so in the US. In West Africa, it's much more about the local fishing communities being faced by threats from offshore trawlers from China and other nations, that including the EU, that threaten their sustainable local fisheries. So where would you say consumers are most active or most effective in promoting sustainable seafood?
So I still think it's that being able to signal to businesses that you want to see sustainable seafood. And I often struggle with, you know, feeling like, well, you're just one person. You're just one voice. How can what you put in your cart actually make a difference? But, you know, we work with these major retailers and major buyers of seafood at this vast scale. And time again, it's actually this consumer voice that brings them to the table that allows us to start those conversations. So asking the question is actually going to make a difference. I know it doesn't feel like that when you're just one person, but it really does make a difference. So I would encourage folks to continue to ask, is this seafood sustainable? Do you sell sustainable seafood? Where can I find sustainable seafood? Anything along those lines is going to show that indication of demand loud and clear to your business.
There we go. Thank you, Aaron Hudson, Director of the Seafood Watch Program at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. It was a delight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.